This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman has worked and written on social justice issues for decades. As a minister, he most recently served as pastor of St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Detroit's Corktown neighborhood near the site of the old Tiger Stadium. Bill Wiley Kellerman is the keynote speaker for this weekend's 16th annual Interfaith Peace Service. The address, which begins Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Kalamazoo, is sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. It's called Breaking the Reign of the Giant Triplets. Bill Wiley Kellerman, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Gordon.
So the Giant Triplets, this is references a quote by the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Tell us a little bit about what the Giant Triplets are. What are you talking about in this speech?
Right. As listeners would know, I hope April 4 marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. And it's also just 1 year prior to that, exactly on April 4, that he gave a really important address at Riverside Church in New York, where he articulated his opposition and response to the war in Vietnam. And in the course of that, really the heart of that speech was a call for a revolution of values. And he said, without that revolution of values, that the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and extreme materialism could not be conquered. So, at the heart of that speech were those giant triplets. You can think of them as social pathologies or issues. I tend to think of them in the context of the New Testament tradition of principalities and powers. They're actually ideological structures of powers that reign and rule even more now, I would say, than 50 years ago. So addressing those and how we break those in our own lives and as movements is really crucial and important.
You would say that we've gone backwards on those issues in the 50 years since the assassination of Martin Luther King?
Yes, I would say that's true. The great advances that both the freedom struggle made and what he was organizing at the time of his death, and I think it's fair to say the reason that he was killed was the attempt to bring together the three movements that are connected with the triplets, which were, of course, the freedom struggle itself in response to racism, the anti-war movement, then focused on the war in Vietnam. And what he was pulling together were the Poor People's Campaign in that following summer of 1968 for economic justice, the response to what he was calling extreme materialism. And there was a lot of momentum building for a real transformation, as he put it, a revolution of values in our culture. And I would say since that time, the extremes between the rich and the poor have only accentuated, becoming absurd in many ways. Poverty, there are more people living below the poverty line than there were in Dr. King's time. In the present moment, one in two of Americans live either in poverty or in low income. So, and race is more and more explicitly the white supremacy in our country is really explicitly embraced.
One of the issues you've worked very hard on is the water shutoffs in Detroit, trying to keep water on for residents who have not been able to pay their bills. Does that fit in with that idea, that part about, extreme materialism? Does that play into the idea that Martin Luther King was talking about in trying to alleviate poverty?
Yes, I would say it absolutely does. Maybe I'll say one preliminary thing to moving into the water is that at present there's a new poor people's campaign, a national call for moral revival that's been initiated and is really coming into full swing as a launching of a movement in. Actually, the campaign's targeted 25 states to be participants, and at this point there are 40 states who are building for the campaign, which will launch in May and June of this year in a very substantial public civil disobedience campaign way. And I would say our situation in Detroit feeds directly into that. It is, of course, a bottom-up movement of poor people and resistance from street level up. And in Detroit, water has been a huge issue for us. You probably know, or listeners would know, that Detroit's in the process of restructuring itself physically, that we're a city that at once held 2 million people and now is about 700,000. So the logic of reducing the footprint to certain neighborhoods is waterfront, downtown, Woodward Corridor, some other select neighborhoods is part of what's going on in, at the present time in Detroit. But that also means there are neighborhoods that don't have a future, where people are really being driven out of neighborhoods, obviously poor and black folks largely. And that's by a whole series of mechanisms. Water shutoffs is high on that list. In the last 4 years, there have been upwards of 80,000 shutoffs to homes in Detroit. And that's part of a process of clearing people out of neighborhoods, along with tax foreclosures, mortgage foreclosures, school closings that have been part of the dismantling of public education in Detroit. Church closings actually figure into that, to be honest, and just the removal of transportation, public transportation infrastructure from those neighborhoods as well. So water in particular, this whole process has been accelerated in Detroit by something called emergency management, which of course has happened all over the state in Public Act 436, where virtually in every black majority city in the state has been under emergency management, where in one person appointed by the governor, all the powers of government are vested, everything from writing laws to repealing laws, firing employees, privatizing departments, breaking union contracts, even rewriting the city charter, selling assets, selling public assets, are all part of the powers of emergency management. And when that came into Detroit, I'm trying to think now, 4 or 5 years ago, one of the first things that happened was that Detroit Water and Sewage, under the direction of emergency management, announced that anyone behind in their bill by $150 or 2 months would be scheduled for a shutoff. And that first summer, they scheduled 30,000 water shutoffs to homes in Detroit. And that was just the beginning of this process. That preceded, the Flint water crisis, which rightly so has gotten lots of national attention, also undertaken in the same emergency management process, virtually directed by Governor Snyder.
But we hear a lot now about the comeback of Detroit, that there are, you know, young people who are moving there, that there's, you know, new development, new business, new housing in areas that for years didn't have that. Would you say that that has come at a cost?
Well, yeah, I think I'm naming that cost, and that's that people are being expelled from the city. Certainly the agenda is for, in terms of racial white supremacy and racism, it's really white folks who are being drawn back into the city, folks who have fled, corporations who fled and abandoned the city, of course, now want it back. So, yes, there's certainly lots of money for downtown development. You know, we have a new hockey, basketball stadium that was the land was given to Mike Ilitch for $1. The funding of that substantially, a big chunk of that came out of property taxes, which is to say, school money for schools went into the hockey stadium. So that's the kind of process that we're looking at here, where the cost of poor and black folks in the city is quite heavy. Dan Gilbert, actually, I've just been out of town for a couple of weeks and am back, and in the course of that time, the plan to move the courts, district court, along with the city jail, out of downtown and, you know, farther out into another part of the city. That's been finalized. Gilbert had different plans for that piece of property, from soccer stadiums to hotels. I think the current plan is, you know, a hotel complex, but clearly the agenda has been to move the courts and the jails, black folks, out of downtown.
Well, how does the city, though, manage all of that? I mean, as you mentioned, you know, Detroit's population is diminished. You are trying to bring in investment. How do you, manage a big city which is becoming smaller in terms of population, but not in terms of geography, and do it in a way that does not marginalize the poor people, the minorities, the black people who've lived there for so many years?
Oh, well, yeah, very good question, and very much the question of the moment. It's not what's happening. The assault on democracy from above, where you have every major black city in the state having been, except for Saginaw, I believe, being under emergency management. At one point, half the black population of the state was under non-elected governments, and three-quarters of the black elected officials in Michigan had been replaced by emergency managers. And Detroit remains, Governor Snyder's made a big deal out of the notion that, no city is currently under direct emergency management. But they're all under the emergency management law. There's still a financial review board, which has a veto power over decisions that the city council makes. So that level of control continues in one way or another. Making democracy is a project from below, and neighborhood organizations and communities coming together and attempting to make decisions and build for themselves. It's not going to happen. Democracy isn't going to happen from above. Democracy is really being suppressed. It's actually one of the criteria for the Poor People's Campaign in selecting their 25 states. They were looking at voter suppression and suppression of democracy. And Michigan qualifies for that as kind of the poster child for this emergency management process that really does suppress. It is a voter suppression method. I mean, if you have an election and you're electing people who aren't going to have any power, or if you've signed a petition to get the emergency manager law on the ballot, which of course was done in 2013, the majority of Michigan voters repealed that law. Then the lame duck legislature turns around and repasses it. I mean, your votes just don't count. They don't make any difference. So we're in a situation where we really have to create democracy as a fact of community life in the city.
And does that apply nationwide? I'm wondering at this time when many people interested in the issues you're interested in look at Washington and see the Trump administration and see that Republicans control the House and the Senate and are looking for, as they say, a way to resist. And I'm wondering if you think that what you've just talked about there applies as well, and maybe also some of the lessons that you have preached about civil disobedience and nonviolence.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think nonviolent civil disobedience is really crucial for breaking into the false narratives that so much control us, that development happens with these huge capital shifts will somehow benefit poor people, which is, of course, just a bold-faced lie. So with the Poor People's Campaign, using civil disobedience, in particular at state houses around the country, is going to be an important part of breaking into a different narrative. Here in Michigan, the organizing has already brought 1,200 folks who have said they'll do civil disobedience in the course of the period beginning on Mother's Day in May and continuing through the solstice. So May and June will be a heavily concentrated time of what the campaign is calling nonviolent moral fusion direct action. There's a lot packed into that notion, but nonviolent direct action will be key in this launch period.
Reverend Bill Wiley Kellerman is the keynote speaker for this weekend's 16th Annual Interfaith Peace Service in Kalamazoo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
The address, which begins Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock at First United Methodist Church in Kalamazoo, is sponsored by the Kalamazoo Interfaith Coalition for Peace and Justice. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.